This is the sixth shiur on the Hilchos Tshuva of the Rambam. We're going to start Perek Gimel, third perek. There's no simple halacha on the subject, and it's very complicated. I can't begin to talk to you about it now. Let's see. Here we go. Okay, we're going to start chapter 3. Every human being has merits and transgressions. This is quite a blanket statement. It means nobody is perfectly good, nobody's perfectly bad. Everybody has merits and transgressions. He whose merits are more than his transgressions is called a tzaddik, righteous. He whose transgressions are more than his merits is called a rasha, wicked. Now, let me stop to comment immediately that these terms, righteous and wicked, are very widely used, are used in a variety of ways in a variety of contexts. This is one definition out of a dozen or maybe 20. So you can't apply what's said about these words in one context to another context. And Rambam is using it here, specifically in this context, for a specific purpose. But in other contexts, it'll have a different meaning. So don't take this as a blanket description of what tzaddik and rasha are. Here, he says it depends upon the majority, which would mean, roughly, everyone is either a tzaddik or a rasha. Right? And we don't use the word tzaddik that way colloquially. We think of tzaddikim as a very, very small, tiny minority of people. So that's a different meaning. That's a different criterion. Anyway, majority of merits is a tzaddik. Majority of transgressions is wicked, rasha. Mechz lemechzo, he's 50-50, beinoni. He's in between. Of course, one might wonder how many of those are. We'll get to that in a session. Okay. Similarly, the city or a region or a state, if the merits of all its inhabitants are greater than its transgressions, then that city or state or region is righteous. And if the transgressions are greater than its wicked, and the same goes for the world as a whole. Now that may sound natural and obvious, but it isn't at all. Let's think for a minute. Each person is judged by his majority. Okay? Now let's say we have a group of 10. How would you analyze the status of the group? Whether the group should be called righteous or the group should be called wicked? The Rambam says simply, add up all the actions of all the 10 people. Add them all up. And if the majority is merits, then the group is meritorious. And the majority is transgressions, then the group is wicked. Could you think of some other way to do it? Yeah.
Majority of the actions or majority of the group?
Oh, good. Now explain what you mean by the majority of the group. What's the other alternative? Exactly right. Here's the alternative. Don't just put all the actions of the 10 people into a big pot. Start by judging each person individually. Person by person. Now you might have, let's say, 6 people whose majority is wicked and 4 people whose majority is righteous. But let's suppose that the 6 people whose majority is wicked are just barely wicked. Each of the 6 is 50% plus 1. And the 4 who are righteous are spectacularly righteous. Everything they do is righteous, but one mistake. then you'll have a contrast, you'll have a contradiction between the two criteria. If I count it action by action, could be that the group will be regarded as righteous. If I count it person by person, it will be regarded as wicked. Am I going too fast? Should I do it in more detail? Let's do it in more detail. Okay? You have 10 people, and each person performs 20 actions. So now you got 2,000 actions, right? Let's suppose that 4 people are 11-9. 4 people have 11 bad actions and 9 good actions. So those 4 people, no, 6. 6 people are 11-9. 6 people are 11-9. So those 6, each one is wicked. The majority of the people is wicked. But let's suppose the other 4 are 19-1. 19 good and 1 bad. So let's see. What's the sum total of say again? Yeah. And now for the other 4, it's 4 times 19, which is 76. 76 good and 4 bad. So that, and in terms of the individual actions are far more good than bad. But in terms of people, you have more bad than good. So you could do it either way. You could imagine doing it either way. And according to the Rambam, you just count actions. Every action is counted separately. If you do it the other way, then people count independently from actions. You start by establishing identity for the people, and that carries the day. So, actually, there's some discussion among the other comments. I'm just pointing out, the Rambam's criterion here isn't obvious. There is an alternative, but this is the way he's doing it. With, yeah. This is the context. We're coming to that. Okay. We're coming to that. Okay, that's exactly what I want to take you through in detail now. Okay, now, says the Rambam, in the beginning of the second law, a person whose transgressions are more than his merits dies instantly in his wickedness. And he quotes a verse. As I told you, throughout here, he quotes a verse for everything. And the same is true for the city or the region. Immediately is lost, quotes. And so it is also for the world as a whole, if the majority would be transgressions over the merits, then all of it would be destroyed as it was in the flood, and he quotes the verse from the flood. Ki Rabba ro'as ha'adam al ha'aretz. Rabba, we translate as most. We translate Rabba as multiplying and expanding. He takes it literally. Rav means majority. Because the majority, down the drain, as they say. Right? Now, the Ravid, who I told you is older than the Rambam, and therefore when he criticized the Rambam, you know, he has no hesitation and no worries about his position. Lo kamo shehu sover, not the way this author thinks. He quotes a Gemara, which he thinks the Rambam has misunderstood. On the contrary, he says, there are wicked people who live long. But rather, they get judged in a certain way, that it is a long time for the judgment to be carried out. Says the Rav, it's simply not true. And in particular, wicked people live long. And as I told you, the Kesef Mishnah says the answer to the Rav's objection is in the continuation of the Rambam's words. The Rambam goes on to say, this evaluation, shikul, which literally means weighing up, is not according to the number of merits and transgressions, but rather according to their size. There's one merit that corresponds to many transgressions. He quotes a verse. And there's a transgression that corresponds to many merits. He quotes another verse. And the only one who can make this evaluation is Kael Deos, the God of Deos. He alone knows how to evaluate merits versus transgressions. I told you that this title Kel Deos, in the Rambam's language, means the God of the heart, character traits. Because in this section of the Mishnah Torah called Sefer Amado, the first section, he has a whole set of laws called Hilchos Deos, and they are the laws of character traits. Furthermore, the phrase Kel Deos is a quotation from the Tanakh, from Chana's prayer, and there she's saying, only God knows what I really intended, what other people intend, only God knows the inner life of a person, and she speaks of God there as Kel Deos. So the Rambam is saying here, only the one who knows the inner life of the person can evaluate the size, the impact, the value of the person's different actions, his merits and his transgressions. This means that the evaluation is not made on legal grounds. If it's evaluation made on legal grounds, there's no reason for God to know the heart. He don't need to know the heart in order to know the legalities. And in principle, a person could know it too. Violation of Shabbos is much worse than eating a cheeseburger. And eating a cheeseburger is much worse than omitting putting on tefillin. And omitting putting on tefillin is much worse than not making a blessing before you eat. Legally, these things are well known and uncontroversial. So if it were a matter of a legal evaluation, in rough and ready terms, we could do it. Might be difficult to put a metric on it. You know, twice as much and two times, you know. But at least we could certainly make comparisons. The Rambam says this can only be done by evaluating the inner life of the person who's performing the action. In other words, we're not evaluating the action so much as the agent. Two people can perform the same action externally. Their bodies go through the same motions and they have the same effects. But the agent behind the action will be evaluated in utterly different ways. Take a doctor who 150 years ago bleeds people with fevers, and a doctor 100 years ago who bleeds people with fevers. They're both bleeding people with fevers. The first is a conscientious, reliable, compassionate doctor, and the second is a criminal. What's the difference? They're both bleeding people with fevers. The difference is that a little more than 100 years ago, it became well known that when you bleed people with fevers, you're injuring them. The first doctor did it because it was the best medical practice that they knew of at the time, and the second doctor is a criminal. So looking externally at the action doesn't tell you how to judge the agent. Says the Rambam, don't look at the action externally. You have to judge what it means in the life of the agent. And that none of us is capable of doing. So when the Ravid objects, but we see wicked people who live long lives, the Rambam will say, you don't see anything. Who are you to look at a person and say that he's wicked or righteous? You can't evaluate the size of the actions that he performs, and therefore your judgment is not relevant. Okay? This is very, very important because people have to know that it isn't a mechanical legal system. Very often I get emails from people who write and say, it says in the Torah don't do X. Does that mean everybody who does X is going to hell? You know, that's the way they write. You've had emails from people who write that way. The answer is, of course, no. From the fact that it says don't do it and he's doing it, you can't defer anything. You have to know more about the agent in particular. Does he know better? Could he know better? Is he in control or is he out of control? What pressure is he under? All of that is relevant. Okay. Now, anyone who comes to regret mitzvahs that he has done, and he taha is more like I wish it hadn't happened. You know, if it was up to me to wave a wand, I would wipe it out of history on the merits that he got. And he says in his heart, what did I accomplish when I did that? I wish I had not done it. He loses all of them. He loses them. And in the end, well, none of them will be mentioned in his merit. It'll just be wiped out. And he quotes a verse. Now, Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman here raises a very interesting question. Rambam is saying, changing your mental attitude is enough, Rachmana Litzlan, to lose the credit for the mitzvahs that you've done. Imagine a person, he's on the phone, and it's late afternoon, and he's doing a business deal, and it's time to daven mincha, the afternoon prayers, and he says to the guy on the other phone, you know, I have to daven, I'm sorry, I'll be back in 10 minutes. He comes back in 10 minutes, the guy's already on the phone with somebody else, he loses the deal. He finds out the deal was worth $75,000, and he says, boy, was I a fool. I could have davened mincha later, I could have made it up by davening Meir twice. That was a mistake, I shouldn't have done that. I wish I hadn't done that. That's it. He loses credit for that mincha. It's wiped out. Now says Rabbi Yochanan, let's compare what it takes to wipe out a mitzvah with what it takes to wipe out a transgression. Let's see. We just learned that wiping out a mitzvah requires just a change in attitude. That's all. Wishing he hadn't done it. What does it take to wipe out a transgression? No, sir. But then you haven't been here all the time, so you don't know. What does it take to wipe out a transgression? Well, okay, the first two are the same thing twice. There are three things that you have to have. One is abandon it, don't go back to it in the future. Second is regret it. And the third is? No, that was the first. Confession. To wipe out a transgression, you need three things. Regret, accepting not to do it again, and confession. To wipe out a mitzvah, all you really need, what is the one thing corresponding that you need, is really regret. I regret I did it. Now Rabbi Yochanan says, why would it be easier to wipe out a mitzvah than it is to wipe out a transgression? We have a rule that God's mercy and God's kindness far outweigh his strictness and his justice. Here, it seems like it's the opposite. Wiping out a mitzvah is terrible. Wiping out a mitzvah is an aspect of strictness. And strictness here comes down in like a ton of bricks. Just regret it, and you lost it. Wiping out a transgression is God's mercy and kindness. To get that, you got to work very hard. To get that, you got to regret and resolve not to do it in the future and confess. Seems backwards from the normal bias in favor of kindness and mercy. Rabbi Yochanan answers to at least restore balance. It doesn't explain how you can go over one is stronger than the other, but restore balance by distinguishing two aspects of every performance, whether it's a mitzvah or a transgression, and analyzing which element is addressed to each aspect. Let's take a transgression. In each transgression, there are two components. One is rebellion. God said, don't do it, and the person's doing it. So he's rebelled against God, rebelled against God's authority. Number two, there are consequences. The world is affected. It's obvious if he steals something, or he destroys something of somebody else, or hurts someone, or insults someone. But even if not, our world has an underpinning hidden dimension where what we do here affects the whole spiritual structure of the world, the scaffolding of the world. And therefore, if we perform a transgression, God forbid, it means that the flow of divine energy to the world is diverted or reduced, diluted, has consequences for other people. There are the consequences of the action independent of the fact that God said not to do it. I wonder, as I'm telling this to you, there's a category of commandments which are logical. Many hold, the Rambam among them, that if it's logical, you have to do it just because it's logical. I wonder if you rebel against a logical commandment, whether there's any rebellion involved against God's authority. Depends on how you look at logic. That would be a nice thing to analyze. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I'm just trying to separate them out.
Wouldn't there be more rebellion against God's authority?
I don't know. There's a question whether the logic has to be understood as God speaking through you in some sense, or whether logic is somehow independent. I don't know. But anyway, there are these two aspects. Now, says Rav Chanan, intuitively, if you're talking about the rebellion aspect, so then regretting it is enough. If you rebelled against God's authority, now you say, I shouldn't have done that, I wish I hadn't done that. So that compensates for the rebellion that's in it. If we're talking about the actual damage that it's done, then the person says, I know it causes damage, I'm not going to do it again. I don't want to cause that kind of damage in the world. So the two components of tshuva are necessary because the action had two effects, two dimensions. Now Rav Chanan says it could be that in the case of the mitzvah, all that you lose is the obedience aspect. That I'm obedient in doing what God wants. That's what gets lost when the person regrets. But the effects of the mitzvah, may stand. They stand. They're still in existence. They're not wiped out. In which case, what you're now saying is that mitzvos and transgressions are treated on a par. Not wiping out mitzvahs is easier than wiping out transgressions. They're treated on a par. The Rambam here is talking about the merit that the agent gets. If he regrets it and therefore loses the obedience, if he loses the obedience, then there's nothing left in it for him. Just that the effects it had in the world could remain. They just remain now anonymous. They have nothing to do with him. At any rate, one has to say something. Otherwise, you end up with this kind of imbalance. Okay, now I'm skipping to four because the rest of three is very, very complicated issue, and I haven't got time or ability really to go through it in detail. The fourth halacha talks about Rosh Hashanah. Even though the Shofar Rosh Hashanah is a biblical decree, there's a hint in it. Rambam does this very often. The Rambam has a general position. Every person, he says, every person should analyze, try to understand the meanings of the commandments. I'm using my choice of word, meanings of the commandments. Yes, God said to do them, and that's enough authority to make them binding. But they also communicate. God is communicating through these commandments. And one should seek out what the communication is. And here he's giving us an example. The shofar blast is as if to say, wake up, you who are asleep from your slumber. And nirdomim is like people who are sort of unconscious in a more fundamental way, from your unconsciousness. Analyze your actions and return in tshuva. And remember your Creator. Those who forget the emes, maybe if we have time, I'll tell you what emes is. Emes is not truth. In the vanities, futilities of our temporary world, and they dissipate their whole year in worthless activities, which will not value them, not do any profit for them, and will not save. Look to your souls. Improve your ways and your strategies. And each one should abandon his evil way and his thoughts that are not good. That's the hint in the shofar. The hint of the shofar is that the whole year, one is living, and life is a precious gift, and the preciousness of life is the opportunity to do something significant, which means to develop the soul. And all year long, we waste our time in sleep, in a trance, unconscious of the reality. That's closer to what Emes is. Unconscious of the reality. Shofar, Rosh Hashanah, is a call to wake up at least once a year. Now comes the tricky part. Therefore, he says, a person has to see himself all year long as if he's half merits and half transgressions. 50-50, what he called the beginning of this chapter, Beinoni, an in-between person. And he should see the whole world as if it's half merits and half transgressions. And therefore, if he, this person who's now thinking, if he performs one transgression, he will push the world over, himself and the whole world, over to the obligatory side, to the failure side. And then the world will be destroyed. Because as he said above, everything is judged by its majority. If he does one mitzvah, then he's pushing the world, himself and the world, over to the merit side. And he's causing for himself and for the whole world salvation. He quotes a verse. Now, this should exercise us a little bit. How realistic is this? I should look at myself as 50-50? What is the probability that I'm really 50-50? And what's the probability that the whole world is really 50-50? You know, I would say it's about zero. You know, if you want to be generous, it could be 0.00000001%. That'd be generous. Otherwise, it's zero. Why should I take on this gross fantasy and think it and you know, internalize it as my point of view and act on it when it's just vanishingly small, that it should be true? Yeah.
Because if you think that the world is 50-50, and you're 50-50, and that your actions control the fate of the world, you'll do the mitzvah because you don't want to be the sole reason that the world is a certain.
Okay, so you're saying that this is my first answer, that it's a psychological matter. Maybe it's not perfectly realistic, but your performance will benefit from internalizing this fantasy. This isn't so far from common experience. It's halftime in the football game, and your team is down 21-6. And the coach is speaking to the team, and he says, "Listen, you can do it. We can pull it out. You know, I mean, they're tired, and I know a few secret plays, and we can turn it around. All I have to do is give it your best, and so forth and so on." Now, what's going on here? You know, it's 21-6. And they're smashing us. You know, they're just walking all over the field on us. However, he knows, and experienced players know, that if you work yourself into a state of mind that you can win, then instead of losing by 42-9, you lose by 28-15. You know, you'll do better, right? So with this pumped up artificial state of mind, you'll do much better. And what you do is you kind of split your mind. You know, your cool, calm, disconnected, rational mind says, "This is bunk, you know, what is he talking about?" But you put that part of your mind on hold. And you listen with your emotions, and you hear, and you internalize it, and you go out there, and you go out there to kill him, right? And you do better than you otherwise would have done. So I think there's something realistic in this kind of psychology, and it could be, on one level, that the Rambam is talking about that kind of psychology. Yes?
And the thing that you're so good is you don't have to do something positive.
Yeah, okay, that's close to what he's saying. Now, you did stick into your remark one word which you know, needs to be taken with care. If I fail, I'll be the only one who's responsible for the destruction. You did say only one, and that's not quite right, and that's what I want to analyze now. Let's suppose the world is 60-40 on the side of good. It better be, because otherwise it's not going to be here long, right? It's 60-40 on the side of good. And I perform a good action. Okay, it's 60-40, so it's over half. Which of the actions on the 60 side put it over half? Which one? It's 60%, you know, it's just 60. There's a whole bunch of them, right? Can you pin it on one action and say, this is the one that put it over half? There's no way to do that. But what? Everyone who contributed to the 60 is contributing to the salvation of the world. and everybody's contributing equally. So I might look at my action and say, my action is saving the world. That is to say, my action together with all of the rest of them, all of them, but every one of them counts equally. If you ask, why is the world saved? The answer is because there's this chunk of 60 here, and that's what's saving the world. So my action can take significance from the salvation because it's part of the majority. Is that exactly the same as saying that it's 50-50? No, but it's to counteract the mistake of thinking I'm just one cog in a wheel, I'm just, you know, one out of millions, and therefore it doesn't matter. This concept that I'm one out of millions and it doesn't matter is a difficult and a controversial concept, which I'm going to spoil with you for a little bit, because I do think it's relevant here, though I don't think we're getting all of what the Rambam means, but what I said before, what I'm saying now, are part of what he means, and the rest of it I don't fully understand. Why should anyone pay taxes? The United States budget is, I don't know, $1.5 trillion a year. My few thousands aren't going to make any difference to that budget at all. They're not going to change any project. They're not going to do a deal or not do a deal. Perform it. It has no effect whatsoever. So why should I pay my taxes? You know, you put your money into something, you do it for an effect. You do it because you want to make something happen. Say, put your money in, but it won't make any difference at all. That sounds utterly futile. Why should I do that? Why should anybody vote? Why should anybody vote? No election can be decided by a single vote. It can't be. Because if you count it up and there's only one vote off, they'll have a revote. Because they know very well that the counting isn't that accurate. So it can't be decided by one vote. So your one vote can't make the difference. It can't make the difference. Okay, maybe you're the editor of the New York Times and you're misleading all your readers and voting the wrong way. I mean, you know, you're having an effect on their opinions and so forth and so on, right? But, you know, I'm talking about a single individual. He's sitting at home. It's going to take him a half hour to go down to the polling station and stand in line for a half hour and then vote. And he says, what do I have to waste an hour for? What am I accomplishing? In what way am I changing the world by spending that hour? Isn't it true the world will be exactly the same if I don't spend that hour? So why should I do it? This is a fundamental question about group actions. Large group actions where the individual's contribution doesn't make any difference to the outcome whatsoever. Why should the individual participate? Now, you said, and it's the natural thing for everyone to say, but if everybody said that, so then it would be a disaster. That's true. What's that got to do with me? I'm just me. I either go or I don't go, right? If I don't go, no one's looking at me. No one's taking lessons from me. No one's observing me. So if the others don't go, they don't go. And if they do go. It has nothing to do with me, my responsibility. Let's say 50% are going to go. So if I go with 50% plus one, the whole thing, the system's going to fall apart. 82% go. If I go with 82% plus one, system will stay together. And 82% would have kept it together anyhow. 3% are going. So if I go at 3% plus 1, it's going to fall apart. No matter how many others decide to go or not to go, my participation isn't going to change the outcome at all. So why is it relevant to me that if everybody said that, it would be a disaster? Well, that doesn't play any role, shouldn't play any role in my decision. Furthermore, this concept, if everybody said it, if everybody did it, it would be a disaster, has to be totally irrelevant, as some philosophers have pointed out. I'm about to turn on my tap at 9 a.m. to get some water. Now I reflect. Suppose everybody decided right now to turn on his tap. What would happen? The water mains would collapse! So I can't turn on my water thing? What, my water? What difference does it make? What would happen if everybody else would do it? You know, it's just not relevant. Right? If everybody... there was a lovely science fiction story, The Law of Averages. The law of averages fails. What will happen? Everybody will go to the Triborough Bridge at the same time, right? You know, it'll be a disaster. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. The law of averages is that some people go and some people don't. But if everybody decided at one moment to go, is that a reason not to go to the Triborough Bridge? Because if everybody went, it would be a disaster? No. So this isn't the right answer to the conundrum. Somehow, we have to appreciate that the individual acting in a large group, his action, now listen carefully, is valuable and significant even though it doesn't affect the outcome. This is a challenge to ethics, challenge to our intuition about what makes things important and significant. Even though it doesn't affect the outcome, it's significant. Here's a case where, I'll give you two cases where it actually works, and I'll tell you one way to understand it philosophically. There are people who volunteered for the army during the Second World War to fight the Nazis. Now you had millions of people fighting that war. This guy is packing rations for the soldiers, you know, in combat. This guy is sorting mail. This guy is preparing telephone lines. And if he wouldn't be there packing rations, what would they do? So they would make everybody else work 5 minutes more, and everybody else, and then all the rations would get packed, you know, or they hire somebody else. I mean, his one out of the 10,000 people packing rations isn't going to make any difference to the outcome of the war one whit. Single soldier shooting bullets at the enemy. The Germans didn't give up because they lost one more soldier. That wasn't what made, you know, turned the tide of the war. Still, the individual soldier who volunteered for the army, went to fight the Nazis, feels that he did something important. He feels he did something important and significant. Why? Because he was part of that group that beat the Nazis. Must we condemn him of living in a fantasy world? Or might there not be there some real idea that he did participate? The conquest was accomplished by the millions working together. True, if you subtract one, it would have been conquered anyway. That doesn't mean that he wasn't part of the group that did the conquest. You probably don't remember, maybe you learned in history books, the name Neil Armstrong mean anything to you? Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Maybe he was a baseball player for the Mariners or something.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, it sounds about right. Yeah. Now, when he walked on the moon, there were something like 10,000 people who were ecstatic. These are the people who worked together to put him on the moon. The people who made the fuselage of the rockets, the people who made the fuel, the people who programmed the computers, people who tested all the electronical components, the people who did the medical work on them, on the astronauts, so they'd be sure that they would be safe. The oxygen, whatever it was, thousands and thousands of people felt a tremendous accomplishment, a thrill, that they were part of putting a man on the moon. The same observation is true there also. Subtract any one of them, he would have gotten there just as well. If they needed what he was doing, they'd have hired somebody else. So, what we have to understand is that being part of a group performance, even if we subtract your part, the group performance would have been just as successful, doesn't mean that you're insignificant. Again, back to the Rambam's case, if you've got 60-40, because you have a majority of good actions, therefore the world is saved, take this one person out, instead of 60, it'll be 59.773. Okay, so it's still a majority. Doesn't matter. Because who says that his actions are over the 50% point and don't matter? Nobody can identify which ones are at 40, which ones are at 30, which ones are at 55. It's the mass of actions altogether that saved the world. And he's contributed to that mass. So the fact that you subtract him doesn't mean that what he does isn't significant. Now, in moral terms, one answer that I have seen, which makes sense to me anyway, is that the reason why you have to vote and the reason why you have to pay your taxes is that if there's a group action and you're benefiting from the group action, it's unfair to benefit without paying your share of the dues. It's unfair to benefit without paying your share of the dues. The taxes, I mean, if the country is reasonably honest and the money actually goes to benefit the citizens, some of it anyway, you know, 2%? Okay, I'm just joking. So then, you are benefiting from the roads and from the anti-pollution devices and from the information and from the army that protects you and the police protect you. You're benefiting from all of that and you're not paying your fair share of it. It's unfair. A little bit like a person who steals rides on buses and he says, My bus ticket is not going to change the transportation system in the city. The system's going to run exactly the same whether I pay my bus fare or don't pay my bus fare. That's true, but who said you should ride the bus without paying your fare? That's just it's unfair for you to do that because you're getting a service without paying for it. So here, it's fairness that drives the person to participate in the group activity. If you think that democracy produces a benefit for your country, that could be open to debate, of course, but if you think so, to enjoy the benefits of democracy and not pay the price of voting is to enjoy a benefit of a group activity without paying the appropriate dues. Same with taxes, same with all the joint actions. Here, the part of what the Rambam is saying is, if you perform an action that's good and it adds to the total of good actions, then your action, together with all the others, is what preserves the world, and you deserve as much credit as everybody else. Because there's no way of saying which one is the one that puts you over the 50% mark. And therefore, and the person who enjoys the benefit of the world being sustained has to pay his dues to it by performing the actions that sustain it. Okay, that I said, I don't think I've plumbed the depths of the Rambam, but we've got a little bit, yeah.
In my way of thinking, you've described the Republican mentality in the U.S. where the Enrons and the Halliburtons, et cetera, don't have to pay their fair share, the Exxon Mobils, et cetera, because they have these tax breaks, et cetera, but it has a ripple effect because everyone, it's leading by example. So if one person thinks that they don't have to do it because someone else doesn't do it, you have a ripple effect.
I don't know what you're identifying as my position. You think I'm saying people don't have to pay taxes?
No, not at all. Not that you're saying that, but I think that everyone's action matters. That even in a democracy with 300 million people, I think even one person matters because the effects of one may affect 10, and those 10 may affect 1,000.
Okay.
And the second point is, you know, when you have the 10,000 people in NASA, for example, yes, everyone's irreplaceable, but that may throw up the schedule. Not everyone can substitute in, but that one person who's sick that day or decides to go to the beach may throw up the whole project by days or weeks or months.
Okay, both of your remarks are based on maybes. Now, I'll agree with you. I'll agree with what you said, but I don't think it drives your conclusion. There are people whose example does affect lots of people. I mentioned the editor of the New York Times and gave him the slap that he deserves. Maybe not as many as he deserves, but at least one. yes, there could be people in prominent positions, and they act in certain ways, and they mold public opinion. People follow their example. And the same is true with the people who worked to put Armstrong on the moon. That could be managers in significant positions. They leave, you have to restructure the whole thing and redo the whole thing, and then it could set them off by months and so on and so on. There can be such people. My problem is this. Is it only those people who are obligated to participate? Or is it everybody that's obligated? What about the little people who don't have that effect? No one's looking at them. They don't have anybody else learning from them or following their example. Are they free of the obligation, or do they too have to participate? A guy who's a manager of a corporation and he comes out there and doesn't pay his taxes, so people are going to say, well, if he can get away with it, then I'm not going to do it either. But you have a taxi driver or a bus driver, whatever it is, no one's going to follow his example. No one's going to even know about his example.
I agree that the odds and the probabilities go down measurably in infinitesimal numbers, but the CEO is sitting on the back seat of the taxi driver, and the taxi driver does something right, and the CEO may reflect and say, well, you know what? I can learn from this guy. You never know who you're going to learn from.
The point here is not the facts. The point is not the fact. Let's say in every case there's some probability that it'll affect a lot of people. But let's ask the hypothetical question. A person who's not going to affect anybody, is he free of the obligation? No. So then it's not the possibility of affecting others that drives the obligation. That drives part of it. That's also significant. But there's got to be another independent obligation which has nothing to do with affecting other people. Nobody's free of the obligation. That's my point. That's the point of the problem that as it's raised in philosophical literature. Nobody's free of the obligation. So the reason for it can't be that maybe it'll affect others, even if I suppose hypothetically it'll affect nobody. Right? He goes to the voting station, and he walks into the booth, and he doesn't pull down the levers, and nobody knows. Right? Still wrong. So why is that wrong? And I think the only answer that I know of, it's wrong because he's enjoying the benefits of democracy and he's not paying his dues to participate. And that's unfair to enjoy benefits when you don't pay the dues.
He's not being true to himself.
Well, I don't know what that means exactly. But I'm talking about fairness in enjoying benefits of group action when you're not participating in the group action. It's unfair. Yeah. Okay, I'm not interested now in debating voting. But my point is, in group action, the obligation to participate in the group action can be understood as a matter of fairness. And, you know, he could be paraplegic and he can't go. I can have all sorts of cases where it's different. But that's the whole point now is that the impact of the contribution does not matter. That's not the issue. That's not the issue. Look, I'll give you one more case, then I'm going to quit this because enough of it. 20 people pick up a 200-pound boulder. They walk into your house, and they drop it on your stereo. Right? Okay, you have a good stereo. It's worth $2,000. Right? Now, you come to one of the 20 and say, "Hey, you broke my stereo." He says, "No, I didn't." So what do you mean? He said, "Well, you know, it was only 200 pounds. Each of us was only carrying 20 pounds. If I hadn't carried it, the other 19 could have carried it very easily. They didn't really need me. So I didn't do anything." Are you going to let him go? I don't think so. I think I said, well, it's true, they could have done it without you, but you were there and you participated, so pay. That joint action is like that. The fact that you participated means that you're identified with the action. There it happens to be a crime. Same thing's true if it's a good action. Right. The fact that subtracting you would have not left the action intact doesn't mean you didn't do anything. You, together with the others, participated in this action, and you get all the credit or discredit for the action. That's part of what the Rambam is saying here. Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Let's see, where are we going to go?